This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Now that every moment of teenage life is chronicled on MySpace or in blogs, it's hard to remember that teenagers used to record their lives in journals. And anyone who's ever stumbled upon their old, well-worn diary or a passionate love letter scribbled during study hall knows that what once seemed like Byron might now leave you, well, mortified. Since 2002, David Nadelberg has captured this anguish in the stage show Mortified, in which grown men and women confront their own past through their own primary documents, first-hand tales of love and pain. Now, following the same formula, he has collected their entries in his new book, Mortified: Real Words, Real People, Real Pathetic. Later in the hour, we'll be talking to legendary comedian Phyllis Diller, now nearly 90, about her new DVD. But first, this hour, it's all angst all the time, and we'd like to hear from you. Have you ever stumbled upon the embarrassing evidence of teenage passion? A letter from camp, humiliating diary entries, and of course, the ever-present teenage love letter? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is talk@npr.org. Author, producer, and angstologist David Nadelberg is with us from our Chicago Bureau. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, David, how did you begin to collect this evidence of mortification?
Well, it all kind of began where I was doing something I think a lot of people do is when they become adults and they move or something like that, they uncover some unfortunate written artifact of their past. And in my case, I found a love letter that either luckily or not, I did not give to a girl who I more or less stalked in the 10th grade. And I found it and I just thought, wow, this is atrocious. And funny. And I started reading it to some friends, and I'm not a performer by any stretch. And it just felt like something that there were probably lots of other people with a lot worse writings than I had.
Well, at the risk of mortifying you, can you tell us a little bit more about that? Give us some details of that letter you found, or?
Sure. It was, the one of the fun parts of that is that I had forgotten that I'd actually written this thing at all, and when I discovered it, I realized that it was a draft, and it was written on the backside just to kind of give you a level of what pretentious, you know, kid I think I was in high school. I was the editor of my school's poetry lit magazine, which mm-hmm. was actually called Etchings. And, of course,
I thought they were all called Etchings.
I think they're all called Etchings, and it's just a big franchise. Uh-huh. It's the McDonald's of angst. And it was on the back of an entry form to that. And so that means there were many other drafts out there. And in our book, we present that draft because it's the only one in existence. And there's even, you know, the crossed off lines and stuff like that that clearly I was debating using and didn't.
So how did you get other people? How did you pull other people into this?
I have no idea. Now, I basically sent out a little SOS and said, hey, I've got this idea. It's called Mortified. And, about 4 years ago, I started this really exciting process and friends started coming to me and then strangers started coming to me. And they all had really interesting things that they had found, and it wasn't just letters and diaries. It was homework assignments, and it was songs, and it was occasionally media. It was home movies and other things. And what excited me about them was that they weren't just embarrassing, but they all revealed something about each of them. And it had this weird sort of autobiography meets archaeology kind of aspect to it, but all in the context of comedy, which was really what I was interested in.
Now, it's a book now, but first it was a show. How did you made it into some kind of a? Is it was a one person show or?
No, it's basically Mortified is we're sort of this comic excavation of teen angst artifacts, and that means we're all these people are sharing aloud all these letters and journals and such in front of total strangers, and so. We launched that in Los Angeles, 4 years ago, and then opened up, just kept doing more in New York, Boston, Chicago, I think we have a show in Chicago tomorrow night, San Francisco, which is sort of our most raucous city. And it's a completely grassroots thing, and really embraced by word of mouth.
Now, we have a clip of the show with performer Gillian Griffiths, or is it Jillian Griffiths?
Jillian
Griffiths. And
she's mortified that you screwed up her name on national radio.
Let me say that again correctly. Jillian Griffiths. And we should say this is a fictional piece. She's imagining that her parents have died and she's in the hospital, but things are looking up because her idols, Duran Duran, have showed up. Let's hear that clip.
At the hospital, I sat in the waiting room with my face buried in my hands. I heard voices walking by. I looked up and I saw John, Roger, and Andy Taylor from Duran Duran! John stopped and looked and stared at me. He started following me. What a weird situation. My parents, who loved me and raised me, have just died. And my future, full of happiness, was following me. I don't know whether to break down and cry or rejoice.
All right, so tell me how that fits into the show, because this is a piece of fiction, a work of fiction, but most of the stories are true.
Yeah, well, you know, the point is that I think what we're trying to do is that we're celebrating these things that we created, you know, as kids, usually kind of ending at around age 19 or so. And in the case of sometimes we'll do fiction pieces, so kids write school essays, or they'll do the poems and songs. And in Jillian's case, she wrote fiction, and what is now known actually as fan fiction, but wasn't a thing back then. And so she's really ahead of her time, and we should give her credit for that. And but what's important about it is that it's just as revealing as, say, had she written a journal about how, you know, Brian McGillicuddy wasn't talking to her in, you know, AP English that day or something.
So this is fiction she wrote when she was a teenager.
Yeah, this is complete fiction she wrote when she was a teenager.
So it's embarrassing fiction that can come back to haunt you as well.
Yeah, and it really just showed her vicarious, you know, she was living through her words in such a, you know, a wonderful way, but also a completely lame way that we're trying to celebrate.
We are talking with David Nadelberg about his book Mortified and the show Mortified, Real Words, Real People, Real Pathetic. If you would like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And we're going to take a call from Monica, who is calling us from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Monica.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Well, first of all, I have to say, I loved what I just heard, the piece about the Duran Duran thing. I recently came across a story I wrote when I was really young about Sean Cassidy being my brother and that we were raised by wolves. So that was pretty exciting to come across.
Why did you write that?
You know what? I was obsessed with Sean Cassidy as a very small child. And,
no, the wolves.
I forget the assignment, but I made a little book and everything that I came across not too long ago. But the point of my call is I'm a drama teacher. I teach 6th, 7th, and 8th graders at a middle school in Columbia, South Carolina. And Mortified is a great name for your show and your book, because finding a student writing a note in my class, I have to confess, is like a highlight to my day. and they truly are mortified when you take it away from them. And I've often thought, as an actor and as somebody who, you know, teaches theater, that it would make a great show. It would make a wonderful play. So I'm so jealous that that you're doing your performances in places other than South Carolina. So,
well, hopefully we'll get to South Carolina. We're really working hard to kind of grow.
Yeah, go down to Charleston for the Spoleto Festival, or Piccolo Spoleto, or something like that.
Now, do your kids know that this is a highlight of your day when you're finding their notes?
You're the meanest teacher in the world.
I try to play it down. I do keep them in a file. And on bad days, much like today, I came out of school and got in my car and heard the topic, and I thought, oh, my God, I've got to call immediately. but it's fun to kind of go back and look. But notes nowadays, a lot of my students use fake names or code names, like Baby Boy and, you know, Chickadee and things like that. So you don't really know. If you find one on the ground, you don't really know who wrote it, but they're fun anyway.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Monica.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. You know, as I was sort of flipping through the book and looking at some of the entries, it did occur to me that this whole landscape is changing radically with things like MySpace, where kids are going on online and putting down their deepest, darkest thoughts on their page for, you know, millions of people to read. It's a whole other thing going on now. And they don't even realize how mortified they may be a few years from now when they realize how many people have seen it.
Well, and it's all digitally archived, so it's a lot harder to lose in a lot of ways. It's not going to rot in the back of a closet. But yeah, it's interesting. It really is that adage of the more things change, the more they stay the same. Because I've talked to a lot of teenagers actually since doing this project, and they still, you know, write letters and they still write in diaries with actual pen and paper. But actually, in our book, the very first entry by Alexa Alamani is several drafts of a love letter that she's writing to a guy. And what we present is all the drafts that lead up to what she sends. And she sends him about four letters. And you see all of her neurotic, you know, variations before she just writes her one word, "Hi, how are you doing?" And that's actually a piece is from an email. So we've actually gotten to that age where we don't realize that. And the reason I left out the fact that that was from an email in the book was, and also in the stage show when we do that, or there's a piece in Chicago that's based on actually a website. It's rare, but that stuff is coming up. And the reason to leave it out at the moment is I find that audiences just, they wind up getting confused, and then they start doing the math in their heads and realizing, oh yeah, I guess email is 15 years old.
Hmm. Do you audition people for your show, by the way? I mean, how does somebody become a mortified performer?
Well, there's a lot of ways to participate. Most people, if they live in a city where we operate, they just go to getmortified.com, and we have a section for casting. And then there's we have a section on our website called Woe and Tell, where anybody 24/7 can actually anonymously post their own mortifying prose and pics. And then other people who are bored, I guess, can vote on that and sort of. It's sort of like an am I hot or not, but sort of am I angsty or not.
Okay. We are talking with Dave Nadelberg about his new book, Mortified, Real Words, Real People, Real Pathetic. We're hoping you'll call with your own stories of finding long-lost notes or embarrassing diary entries. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, or send us an email, talk@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We are talking about the new book called Mortified by Dave Nadelberg. It's an inside look at teen angst and the long-forgotten, or what you might wish were long-forgotten, love notes, diaries, and other embarrassing personal tidbits. You can read an excerpt at the Talk of the Nation page at npr.org. David Nadelberg is with us. He is the chief angstologist, and the full title of the book is Mortified, Real Words, Real People, Real Pathetic. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK or email us at talkofthenation@npr.org. That's talk@npr.org. And joining us now also is Neil Katcher. He is another humiliated party, and he joins us from the studio's NPR West. His humiliating work appeared both on stage and in the book, and he's a writer and screenwriter who lives in L.A. Thanks for being with us, Neil.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you get involved with Mortified?
Well, I had seen a bunch of shows. I actually saw the very first show and was just very motivated from the beginning to sort of go back to my own home, childhood home in New York, and sort of dig up, because I knew I had a lot of bad stuff, or at least some bad stuff, and I knew that the only times I was really motivated as a child to write was when I had faced and sort of failed and been rejected incredibly hard. So I knew I had some pretty bad stuff.
What kinds of things did you write? Were these diary entries? Were they fiction, poetry? What was it?
I had a little bit of everything. I had a couple of poems that were brought on by rejection. One's called Prom is a Fantasy.
Prom is a Fantasy?
Yeah. And it is all about...
it really is.
It was all about me saying, you know, because I didn't want to go to the prom mainly because I was too afraid to ask a girl out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to say that the prom was like the American dream and that it was all just a big fantasy.
Do you have that poem there, or at least an excerpt from it?
Actually, I do.
Okay, why don't you read that for us?
Let's see what I should give you here. Okay. You should go to prom. You should also go to college, get a well-paying job, get married, have at least two children, live in a white house with a white picket fence, and have a dog named Spot. This used to be called the American Dream, but a dream is exactly what this is. Prom is a fantasy, and it goes on from there. But
you
that's,
were a
that's
bitter,
a
you were a bitter teenager about that prom. It sounds like
yes, nothing got me on my high horse on the soapbox more than rejection, and that's basically the theme of my childhood is sort of the concept of being so bitter by not being able to get a girlfriend that I basically blame the entire world for it.
Now you did grow up to be a writer, didn't you?
I did, and it's ironic that the things, the my writings that are getting the most sort of exposure are my worst.
Is there a connection between the teenage you as a writer and the grown-up you? Other than that you're reading your teenage writings to on the air right now, but...
I haven't changed a heck of a lot, that's for sure. But I think I have grown up a little bit, but I don't have as big a chip on my shoulder anymore, that's for sure. But ironically, the coolest thing about this piece for me is that my piece is all about not being able to ask a girl out because of that rejection. And one of the coolest things that's happened as part of performing this piece live is that I've had a lot of sort of reaction from women who sort of connect to it in an odd way, and so it's actually turned into in a weird way a way of asking girls out.
Oh wow, a happy ending. That's good.
Yeah, in fact, when I read this in San Francisco, a girl came up to me after the show and said, "I have angry poetry that's almost as bad as yours," and we've been dating for 9 months now.
All right. Well, we're going to take a call now from Andrea. She is in Kansas City. Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
Have you had any mortifying moments that you'd like to reveal?
Oh, yes, I have. When I was 18, I was having a secret summer dating relationship with someone who my parents would not have approved of, and it ended tragically. And as they have mentioned before, I only would write when I was incredibly sad. And so I filled up a diary with horrible, desperate, you know, whining and complaining. It's so angsty. It's really embarrassing. And there was profanity, you know, everywhere. And I was just angry. And probably about 5 years later, I had moved to California, was going to school. And my mother actually found it and called me. And in it were also pictures, which could have been incriminating. I was pictures of me smoking a hookah, and my mom was convinced like I was smoking pot and doing drugs and had this whole secret life that they knew nothing about. And it took me about half an hour to calm her down, but it's pretty hilarious now. At the time I was devastated, but of course now it's just hilarious when you realize.
Well, do you still have it, or did you burn it, or do you still have it for someone else to find?
That one, actually, I think I threw away. A lot of the stuff I ended up throwing away because it was just focusing on so many negative things in my life. But now I do have a MySpace, and I do write a lot of blogs. And my mother's organization actually has a MySpace.
Uh-huh.
So I am a lot more careful with what I talk about and the words that I use, knowing that she might be able to read it.
All right. Well, thanks for your call.
Thanks.
That's interesting. You know, I was going to ask you, David, it's so interesting that people do save this stuff. And I had the impression, Neil Katcher, that you knew exactly where to go to find those letters when you wanted to find them. You know, people really know where their stuff is stashed, don't they? David.
Yeah, they, you know, I think everybody's got this secret shoebox somewhere, you know, whether it is that or not. And I think often when they go back home, a lot of times it's just still at their parents' house, you know, if their parents haven't moved yet. And it winds up, you know, they go back home and they have no more friends because everyone's moved out of their hometown and, you know, they're in their 30s or whatever. And this is all they got. And they dig it up. And it's a really interesting way to learn about yourself. But an even more interesting way is to just share that. And I encourage anybody, even if they're not interested in Mortified, It is just to share that with just one person. It's a really interesting experience, and you learn a lot about both.
All right, let's take a call from Julie. She's in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, hi. It's such a wonderful topic, and I'm really glad that you're discussing it. I had a question. I do think it's a wonderful way to learn about yourself, to go back and look at your old letters and your old diaries, and I have many of them. But what my concern is that my children are going to learn something about me that I might not want them to learn about. It's also my husband's concern, yet I can't get rid of my old diaries and my old letters. So I just wondered if you had any comment about that.
All right, David or Neil, that's a kind of common problem for people, or perhaps it's not a problem.
Well,
go ahead.
I think when we've actually, it's been weird. We've actually been getting approached a lot by educators of late to come and speak to students or whatever, and even read these. And we've found that when teenagers kind of hear this stuff, it's I guess you're acknowledging, oh, mom and dad may have smoked pot or had sex or something may have happened that you've been lying to them about all these years that didn't exist on your radar, and you're trying to steer them away from. But the important thing is, I think, when they see all this stuff, is that these life experiences really are things that we all go through, and no matter who we are, and that's one of the exciting things about this, is that sort of universality of all this, and then they learn, no matter what's thrown my way, I'll survive. So
Neil Katcher, why did you hang on to your stuff?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not totally sure why I held on to it. I think I've always had a hard time throwing away anything that I wrote. What was ironic in some of the stuff that I held on to is that there were things that I knew I had. There were some things that I had, like, do not open on, with several pieces of tape wrapped around it to make sure that no one would ever kind of look into it, although I'm sure that just made people more curious if they did stumble upon it. But there were a lot of things that I didn't realize that I had kept. And those were that was really the joy for me of going back and looking, was seeing all these things that I hadn't even remembered. Like, some of the love letters I found are to girls I don't even remember talking to. So it's incredibly interesting to sort of see, like, what you were feeling and how strongly sometimes you were feeling something. And in retrospect, not remembering anything about it, I think, is a very interesting sort of part of this entire experience.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Neil.
Thank you very much.
Neil Katcher is a writer-screenwriter living in L.A. He is also the co-producer of The Mortified Show, and he joined us from our studios at NPR West. Lori Fowler is another participant in The Mortified Show. Some of her most heartfelt journal entries were about being a cotton judge. Here she is performing in The Mortified stage show.
September 16th. I don't understand why we have to practice 5 days a week. I have a life outside of cotton. I have homework and stuff to do. I don't think they expect us to do anything except eat, breathe, and live cotton. I'm going to start wearing anything but cotton.
Lori Fowler is now an office manager for a staffing agency in San Francisco, and she joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Thanks for being with us, Lori.
Thanks for having me.
I have to say, I had never heard of a cotton judge before this. What is a cotton judge?
Well, it's actually part of FFA, or Future Farmers of America, and it's kind of a competition. You learn about cotton, and then you go out and you judge it, and just you have to give reasons. There's, like, this whole process to it. You have to take a test. There's just all kinds of things to it. They also do it for dairy and poultry and milk, and you name it, they do it. They judge it.
So when you go back and read these entries about being a cotton judge, you know, what do you think of them when you look at them? And does it seem like this was another person that did this? Or
a little bit. I've moved away from the small town that I've grown up in, and I'm now in San Francisco, which is polar opposite. And there's nothing agriculture related here, really. So I've kind of uprooted my roots and replanted them somewhere where there's no farming really around.
Well, it was funny in the entries that I read was how you were just kind of full of yourself, weren't you, as a cotton judge? You didn't want to take direction from anybody, it seemed like.
Well, I had a long history of family in Future Farmers of America. My grandparents had a ranch. I kind of felt like I knew what I was doing and just let me do it.
And I understand there's some diary entries that you can't even read on the air because you did a lot of swearing, huh?
A little bit. Well, a lot, but it's the one place where I could swear mm-hmm. without getting in trouble. So I just kind of catapulted it all onto my diary.
Is there an entry you could read for us that you can read on the air that doesn't have any swear words in it?
Yes. I am going to change a few words, but it won't lose
okay.
what it was.
All right, you go ahead.
September 9th. I got into an argument with a judge last night when I was given reasons for bowls. The judge told me he was going to mark me down for not identifying correctly what sample 3 was infested with. I was shocked and asked him if it wasn't the corn earworm, what was it? He said it was the cotton bollworm. What the hell? They're the same thing. Same worm. Well, that's when I lost it. I told it was the same thing, just a different name. He told me when it's on cotton, it's referred to as the cotton bollworm, and when it's on corn, it's the corn earworm. I shot back, what if cotton grew across the street from the corn and the worms crossed the street? Then what would it be called? He told me to calm down. Did I? Nope. I continued that it doesn't matter what you call it, it still ate the sample. I then asked him if we had one of the worms and it was found in the middle of the road between the corn and the cotton, then what would it be called? Would a corn earworm by any other name still eat cotton? I walked out and was disqualified from the bowl competition.
That's Lori Fowler. She is reading from one of her journal entries, which is now part of the book Mortified. And you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. That's pretty funny, Lori.
You were pretty indignant. I knew I was right and I wasn't going to back down. And then two, just there was separate, like we had to judge the bowls and then the seeds and the lint and the plants, and each one was separate and just kind of went off on my point.
All right. Well, let's take a call now. We're going to go to John. He's in Columbus, Ohio. Hi, John.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I was just calling. I'm actually a high school biology teacher. I teach mostly freshmen, but I'm just amazed at the number of notes that I find, you know, dropped in my class. Rather accidentally, this is my first year as a teacher in a traditional high school setting. I've done alternative education for some number of years. And so, you know, I've been finding these notes after school in my room, and it just kind of prompted me to go back and, you know, I know that you're talking about that everybody has that secret shoebox, and prompted me to go back and look at some of the notes that I had gotten and some of the notes that I had written, and I'm just kind of astounded at kind of the differences. Much more, at least in ours, I guess in my school, is explicit, so to speak.
The notes that you're seeing from your students now more explicit than what you wrote.
Yeah, by far. I mean, and there are, you know, some of those code names, and, you know, some of it's left to the imagination, you know, and we just had, you know, homecoming about a month or so ago, and some of the notes that are being, you know, picked up between, you know, different students corresponding about stuff. I had, you know, two girls that were obviously writing a note in class, and inevitably there's always something at the end of the note that says, well, make sure that you rip this up and throw it away so that nobody sees it. And that's the one that ends up getting left on the floor for me to pick up and read. And, you know, things left the imagination. Like there was a part of their note that said, oh, you definitely have to teach me how to do that thing before this weekend because I have a date with so-and-so. And it's just kind of like they're not really telling you, but it's all left up to the imagination.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your call, John.
Thanks.
I just wanted to ask you, David Nadelberg, what's the most mortifying story that you've heard or that in all this, going through all this material, what's the funniest or most mortifying experience somebody recorded and saved?
Well, I never actually try to pick favorites or anything like that. I wish I could say mine was the most mortifying. The way I try to answer that is the pieces that I think take the audience on sort of a range of emotions are the ones that kind of excite me the most. You know, one that actually comes to my mind is there's a guy named Mark Finney who's in our book, and it's a really disturbing piece when it's done on stage, and hopefully it is on the page too. And I think it's a good example of some of the range where basically Mark's girlfriend in when he was like 18 or something said, I'm going to dump you. So he said, all right, I'm going to kill myself. And he's way too lazy to actually do that. So he just wanted attention. But you don't say that to a girl, and you certainly don't say it to the ER doc when she takes you to a hospital, because then they put you in a mental ward for several days. And he wrote journals in there, and we happen to have them, and they're fascinating because he's, and he won't mind me saying this, he's clearly crazy.
So this can be serious stuff as well as funny stuff.
Well, darkly funny. I mean,
yeah.
But he's clearly crazy, but not that kind of crazy, and it's all interesting right. Seeing that.
Thanks for joining us today, David. David Nadelberg is chief angstologist, and his book is Mortified, Real Words, Real People, Real Pathetic. We were also joined by Lori Fowler. Some of her diary entries appear in Mortified. She's an office manager for a staffing agency in San Francisco. When we come back, Phyllis Diller. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.